You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, a guest shares legends and lore from the upper Mississippi River. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. On Wednesday, there was a candidate forum for the state superintendent of education race. Incumbent Tony Evers and challenger Lowell Holtz both participated. And just yesterday, the Wisconsin Elections Commission dismissed an election bribery complaint against Holtz and former superintendent candidate John Humphreys. Robert Menser joins us now, as he does every Friday, to look at that and other top news stories of the week in Wisconsin. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He is based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, Rob. Happy St. Patrick's Day.
Happy St. Patrick's Day to you. Well, let's start with this election bribery complaint declined by the Elections Commission yesterday. What happened?
Yeah, so it wasn't bribery. This was the story that made a big splash before the Wisconsin State Superintendent primary. The two conservative candidates for the office had a meeting before the primary and discussed the idea that maybe whoever won could hire the other for some sort of hypothetical high-paying job within the Department of Public Instruction. So this made a big splash before the election, and there were sort of dueling press conferences and a lot of accusations being thrown around. And the liberal group One Wisconsin Now filed a complaint with the State Ethics Commission, making the case that this amounted to unethical bribery. Turns out the Ethics Commission does not agree. This still doesn't look great, of course. These are two, sort of two candidates horse trading in a back room. So, just because the Ethics Commission isn't taking action doesn't mean voters won't necessarily, or shouldn't form their own opinions about it. But not against the law.
Not against the law. And then there was this candidate forum on Wednesday between the two remaining candidates, Tony Evers and Lowell Holtz. What came out of that?
Yeah, so, we sort of have to do this dance every time we talk about the state superintendent because it's a nonpartisan race. But, I mean, the dynamic here is that the incumbent, Tony Evers, is aligned with Democrats. Holtz is aligned with Republicans and has more conservative views on education policy. And there's kind of a, what we saw at the forum was this sort of an insider-outsider dynamic. Because Evers has been in the job since 2009. He's a veteran in the department, and sort of his pitch is that he has worked with school boards all over the state. He's worked with conservatives. He's worked with liberals. He's worked with Governor Scott Walker. You know me, and you sort of know what you're getting with me. Holtz, on the other hand, is definitely making much more of a we need to shake things up sort of appeal as he tries to unseat the incumbent.
Just a few weeks left until Election Day, early voting starting, I believe, already. Do you think we'll see more big news on this one before Election Day?
So this is an important office that has, it doesn't have a... So school boards still make local decisions for local school races, but the State Department of Public Instruction collects a lot of data, and it can have sort of influence over the types of programming that is offered in schools. So it's an important office. Oftentimes kind of a boring office, right? I mean, this is not likely to be the world's highest turnout election. It's typically not, the most exciting election. I would be shocked if we got as much excitement in the next few weeks as we did before the primary, just because that was such a bizarre story that sort of came out of nowhere.
Talking to Robert Menser, storytelling editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. We're looking at some of the top news stories of the week in Wisconsin. National news, of course, the American Health Care Act. It is getting a lot of attention here in Wisconsin. Wanted to ask you, Rob, about some of the response we've seen here, starting with Governor Scott Walker. What's he saying about this House Republican plan?
Sure. So the American Health Care Act is a big soap opera. I love this. I'm one of the very odd people who actually very much enjoys reading things about healthcare policy. So I'm all about this debate. But Governor Walker is like a lot of Republicans, I guess, in that, or really a lot of everyone, in keeping his distance from the bill. This week, at a speech to the Rotary Club of Milwaukee. Walker said that he was going to be talking with other Republican governors. Walker is the head of the Republican Governors Association, and he was going to be talking with them about what changes they want to see to the bill. There are a lot of Republican governors who expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, under Obamacare, and so many of those governors, Republican and Democrat, are worried about the way that the replacement bill would cap and cut the Medicaid program. That would take effect in 2020 under the bill. So every time Walker talks about the bill, he is always talking about changes that are going to be made, that this bill is just a starting point. He's a bit sketchy, I guess, about how exactly that's going to look. And so I think that's all part of the sort of the big soap opera of as this bill sort of slowly moves forward.
And if it does move through the House, it'll have to go through the Senate. As far as Wisconsin senators, I think Democrat Tammy Baldwin is a pretty solid no, we could say at this point, on voting for it. U.S. Senator Ron Johnson, Republican, not necessarily going gangbusters on this either, though.
Johnson is such an interesting case because he made his political name as an opponent of Obamacare. That is how he got his start in politics, is speaking to Tea Party groups about Obamacare as the greatest threat to freedom in our lifetime. That's the way he would speak about it. In the Senate, he has been. A bit more pragmatic, and definitely he's in the camp of people who are withholding a full endorsement of this current bill. It's hard to know how it's going to turn out.
And finally, federal figures released Wednesday show enrollment numbers for the Affordable Care Act. This is the old one, Obamacare, all-time high here in Wisconsin. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I feel like this is significant as a backdrop to all of this. So on Wednesday, we got new enrollment figures for the marketplaces established by the Affordable Care Act. So these are people who are buying on the individual market, getting subsidized plans from private insurers. Obamacare created that market, and in Wisconsin, a little bit shy of a quarter of a million people, it was 242,000 people signed up for health insurance on those exchanges. That is the highest that has been since the exchanges opened. Nationally, the number is 12 million people overall. It's all very complicated and can be very confusing, but one of the things that House Speaker Paul Ryan and others have said is that Obamacare is collapsing. Sometimes Republicans will talk about states where there are very few options available on those marketplaces, and there are those that does exist. Rural Arizona is a bad place to try to buy insurance on the marketplace, but it's worth saying that this is not the case in Wisconsin. In every county in Wisconsin has more than one insurer who offers plans on the marketplace. Premiums for people in Wisconsin were up, but they were up less than the national average. And as we saw with these numbers, that it's the enrollment is growing. So it's just a bit of context for this whole national debate.
I want to wrap up, Rob, with a look at college basketball. Four Wisconsin teams, two women, two men. On the women's side, UW-Green Bay, a powerhouse. They've made a sports name for themselves there, and Marquette. Then on the men's side, Marquette again, and then UW-Madison, another in a string of tournament appearances. They've had some deep runs. They won last night. Up next, the number one team in the country. what are you looking for, Rob?
So they say this is people say this is the best 48 hours in sports yesterday and today, the NCAA tournament. They have all these games during the day. How are we supposed to work, So it's a big, obviously everybody's watching basketball, as they should be, but it's also a local Wisconsin story because there were, a portion of these first and second round games played in Milwaukee at the Bradley Center, and for the last time at the Bradley Center in Milwaukee. The estimates are more than 55,000 people were expected to be in town for the game, so it's a nice economic boost for downtown Milwaukee. And the last one that we'll get in this particular venue.
I'm not a huge college basketball watcher. I did watch the game last night, and it is worth it to have the opportunity to watch Bronson Koenig sink three-point shots one more time. Rob, thanks, as always, for joining us.
All right, thank you.
That's Robert Mentzer, storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. He joins us every Friday to talk about the week's top Wisconsin news. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Throughout American history, the Upper Mississippi River has played an important economic and cultural role for residents of western Wisconsin and beyond. Some would even say the river has taken on a life all its own. Our next guest wanted to dig into the colorful history of the Upper Mississippi River, from steamboats to small towns and everything in between. In a new book, he shares what he's learned about the uniquely Midwestern slice of the nation's most important river. Dennis McCann is a journalist and freelance writer based in Bayfield, Wisconsin. He's the author of several books. His latest, This Storied River, Legend and Lore of the Upper Mississippi. Dennis, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
Well, you're specifically focusing on our part of the Mississippi here, the Upper Mississippi. What's so special about this part of the river?
Well, it's the part that was most familiar to me, which was the easiest, approach for me to take. When I decided to do this, I just sort of arbitrarily said, we'll start in Dubuque and Galena and go north. Mm-hmm. And I've been a number of places south of there, and I refer to those in the book as well. But it just, there's something about that binds the four states together, and that's why.
And you've covered a lot of history in this book. How much has this part of the river changed since humans first settled in the area?
It's completely changed. You know, the river used to run wild. And it was, they used to say that it was so wild that it had all these channels and islands, and it would change direction if it wanted to. You could have a farm on one side, and eventually the next year it would be on the other side of the river. The Mississippi doesn't have linear banks like a lot of rivers that you think about. But what they did to change it so much is when they made it a shipping route and put in the locks and dams, they completely took away the free flow. And so now what you have is a series of a couple dozen pools, and it's still beautiful and it's still fun to be out on, but it's different completely from what it was like.
Before we get into some of the stories you share, can you share your story? You drove up and down the river, you floated up and down the river. Talk about your experiences on the Upper Mississippi.
Well, I spent a lot of time there when I was with the Milwaukee Journal and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I was often on the road the last 10 years especially, but even before that. And so one year I was just doing a series of stories around the borders of Wisconsin. So I said the Mississippi is the border, so I rented a houseboat in Alma and spent a couple days doing that. In 2004, when they had the recreation of the Grand Excursion, which was a riverboat flotilla that started in the Quad Cities in 1854, when they were just trying to expose the river to the upper class, so to speak. Mm-hmm. They had the recreation of that 150 years later, and I took part in that. And that was 4 days on boats coming up the river to as far as La Crosse, where we got off. Four long days of banjo music and just kind of poking along slowly, but it was just wonderful.
I think when people think of Mississippi River and history, they're going to think of that image of the steamboat.
Right. The steamboats are what everybody associates, especially when you look at Mark Twain and his famous line about every boy on the river wants to be a steamboat man. And that was a relatively short-lived period, but it was a very vibrant period because there were so many, hundreds and hundreds of boats, once they finally figured out how to get upriver as well as down.
And you tell the story of one of those steamboatmen, Diamond Joe Reynolds, and people think of this like boisterous, hard-drinking, hard-bitten character. This was not Diamond Joe Reynolds.
No, the reason I wrote about Diamond Joe is that most people know about the Diamond Joe Casino in Dubuque, and so that's what they associate with the name. But in his day, he was probably the premier riverboat man. He was a grain shipper, and in order to guarantee that his grain could go where he wanted it to go, he bought a boat and then eventually developed a line and became quite a figure on the river. And he famously did not gamble, despite the fact that there's a casino named after him. He didn't drink, and he said he didn't swear much. But he was a colorful guy, and everybody thought he was Diamond Joe because he wore big diamonds, but it was not the case. It was just the way that he signed his name that distinguished that he had two little marks that looked like a diamond next to it. And
Yeah, not diamonds, didn't buy or sell diamonds, and he didn't gamble with diamonds.
He certainly did okay for himself along the way, but he did not dabble in diamonds.
Let's talk some about the scenery. Driving up and down the Great River Road and stopping off the parks on either side of the river, can you share some of your favorite scenic views of the river?
Oh, the one that comes first to mind is in Alma at Buena Vista Park, which is up on the bluff. I forget how many feet up, but you have just this commanding view both ways, and you get to see the lock and dam in the historic little town of Alma. And another one would be over on the Iowa side. If you go to McGregor and cross the river from Prairie du Chien and go up to Pike's Peak, and there's an overlook there that's quite dramatic, and it hangs out over the river. And you stand at that, and you're looking down at the confluence of the Wisconsin River and the Mississippi. And if you just sort of close your eyes for a minute, you can think of the first explorers canoeing by and things like that. And it's just a beautiful area.
Talking to Dennis McCann, his new book is called This Storied River, Legend and Lore of the Upper Mississippi. Dennis, throughout human history, rivers are a place where we humans like to settle, to build our communities. Can you talk about some of the history, pre-European even, of people settling along the Upper Mississippi?
Well, the rivers were always the highways before there were such things. And so that's why they were so important. Explorations of the United States were done on rivers because that's how you could get around for the most part. Lewis and Clark, famously paddled around in the West, and it was the same here. Natives used the rivers for many, many years before white people came along and needed them for the same reason. So it's just a matter of they were a highway system before there was such.
Now, I understand from your book we're sitting in Wisconsin's capital right
Correct.
Now. Didn't have to be that way. There were some plans to situate our capital on the river.
Right, down at...
Or next to the river.
Next to the river, right. I mean, there were several other places that were considered as capitals for Wisconsin, but the first governor, Nelson Dewey, was from Cassville, and he had a place down there called Stonefield, which is now a state historic park. And there was an effort for a brief period to make the capital down there. It didn't happen, and... But he was the first governor, and so they get a little credit for that.
And do they? There are monuments to him there now.
Well, his former place, Stonefield, is a sort of a museum of farm life in Wisconsin, mm-hmm. early farm life in Wisconsin. So it's not necessarily a monument to him, but it was his place, and it's he's certainly remembered.
But he wasn't necessarily remembered later in his life. He got kind of the cold shoulder from his own party.
Yeah, he wasn't a party. An influential party figure. They sort of settled on him as the first governor, and he later went to a party convention and was sort of ignored, and he went home and never came back to Madison for those things again. He's kind of a tragic figure in some ways. His wife left, and he lost contact with his son, and so I think he probably died a lonely man.
Mm. And you also write about an economic boom that I'd heard a little bit about it. I wasn't that familiar with it. The Great Button Boom that was affected La Crosse and other cities along the Upper Mississippi.
All along there, yeah. I think the sort of the epicenter of it was Muscatine, Iowa, mm-hmm. where there is still a museum dedicated to that subject. But they would, before they had such things as plastic buttons, they would use clamshells. And there was a German immigrant who perfected the system of making buttons out of these. And when they started doing that, they had factories up and down the river. There was a major one in La Crosse, and they had set up camps along the river, and the clammers would go out and bring in millions of these clamshells and sort them and treat them and send them to the factories, and then they would have women sitting there turning them into buttons, and buttons shipped all across the country.
I want to bring on a caller. Doug is on the line in Lancaster. Doug, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I absolutely love this subject. I ride a motorcycle. I live in southwestern Wisconsin. I'm on the River Road almost every weekend when the weather starts getting nice. And I love that you mentioned Buena Vista. That's one of my favorite stops. But there's another one just a little bit south of there. If you go down to Gutenberg, that also is an overlook. Usually there's somebody there selling fresh honey. And there's a gorgeous overlook right over there as well. You can see the lock over at Gutenberg.
Right. There's a park along the river there that the women in the community established very early on, and it was really great planning because you can just walk for more than a mile or so up the river, and there's benches facing the water, and you can sit all day and watch boats go by, and it's a great place to watch the lock because it's right in the center of town.
Doug, thanks a lot for that call, and that reminds me, you tell the story of the spelling of Gutenberg, named after Gutenberg, the printing press guy, with
right.
an extra T.
It might be my favorite story in the book because there was a German community and they wanted to honor the father of movable type for his great invention. And so when they established the community, they sent the plats away to be prepared and set them to, I think, of someplace in Cincinnati or someplace. And when they came back, the guy who had prepared it had spelled it with two T's. And, of course, Gutenberg favored with one T. And so the father of movable type is remembered by a typo.
And we call it Gutenberg now,
Gutenberg. Not
Gutenberg,
right.
As I would pronounce the printing guy.
Well, yes, but there was a referendum later on to change this because some in the community were very embarrassed that they had spelled their hero's name wrong, and they turned it down because of just the hassle of changing the name and the spelling.
And all the printing that would be involved.
So he's forever remembered for this typo.
Any other facts as you did your research, Dennis, that surprised you, that were totally new to you about the Upper Mississippi?
Most of the stories were fairly familiar to me from my time on the river. Mm-hmm. The one thing that was new to me was that I had never been to the headwaters in Lake Itasca, up near Bemidji, Minnesota. And there was a long, long search for the headwaters of the Mississippi. And maybe that was the neatest surprise when I got up there. It's a beautiful park with great old growth trees. And you go to the very beginning of the river, and there's a little half-log bridge, and you can step across the Mississippi River, and you have... You really have to wonder how it becomes the great river that it is later on, just on that modest little start there.
And, Dennis, make the case for people who haven't taken the time to go to the western part of the state and just soak in the history and the beauty of the river.
Well, the Great River Road is one of America's greatest highways for touring. And it's not just in Wisconsin either. I mean, on both sides of the river, I sort of make the case that you should just cross over and make sure you stop at every historic marker and overlook, and just sit along the river and watch the boats go by. It's a great place.
Dennis, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Dennis McCann. His new book is called This Storied River, Legend and Lore of the Upper Mississippi. Coming up, a look at youth justice and prisons in Wisconsin in an effort to find a new approach. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Tune in tonight after 7 for lively political conversation on Ken Rudin's Political Junkie. That's tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network. Now, according to a new poll released by Youth Justice Milwaukee, a majority of Wisconsinites would like to see fewer juvenile offenders sent to youth prisons such as Lincoln Hills or Copper Lake. The poll comes at a time when youth prisons in the state are under heightened scrutiny after allegations of abuse and neglect by guards at those facilities. Jeff Roman joins us now to talk about the poll and the state of youth justice reform here in Wisconsin. He's a member of Youth Justice Milwaukee. Jeff, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on. Pleasure to be here.
Well, tell us some more about the takeaways from this poll.
Well, yeah, I can talk about the takeaways about the poll. I think the most resounding thing that we're seeing is that there's been sort of a shifting in sort of ideas on what to do with young people who are having to face and be involved in the juvenile justice system. And so we're seeing an overwhelming majority of Wisconsinites who would rather see young people be provided with additional resources and supports for their neighborhoods and their families so that there are alternatives, I should say, to going being sent to prison and being incarcerated.
And some of the specific questions ask things like, even in cases where they are incarcerated, should they be within a certain number of miles of home? Should their families have access to them? And that seems like it's generating a contrast with the current situation where especially youth offenders from Milwaukee are way far north, pretty far away from home.
Right. Yeah, and I think all the data leads to, and all the data and research is showing us that pro-social development is important for young people. A young person's brain is still developing up until even age 24 and 25, and so a part of the development process is about pro-social development, making sure that there are linkable or tangible linkages to family and community and sort of the customs and traditions of those communities that where they're growing up in. And if we're talking about rehabilitating young people, those same things apply, the pro-social development with family members, the being able to be exposed to resources and different things in those communities are part of a young person's development. And when you take those things away, we're not creating remedy. We're actually just doing punishment. And we all know that punishment is not a remedy. And so in order to be really rehabilitative and really help to transform and transcend some of the things that our young people are doing, we have to make sure that they have access to family members and positive supports from those they're familiar with.
There's this ongoing investigation by the FBI now, though it's not clear exactly what stage they're at, looking at Wisconsin's current main youth juvenile corrections facilities, Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake, allegations of abuse, neglect, not providing classes for kids. These are also supposed to be schools. What do you make of the current state of affairs, what we have now in Wisconsin?
Well, I think it's just symptomatic of a failed model, that the current juvenile justice youth prison system that we have here in Wisconsin and across the nation just doesn't work. It's an outdated, failed model that's disproportionately based on biases and disparities, racial disparities. There are proven practices and proven models that are working now, given the culture and the context of our community now, where there are different considerations that we have that we need to give young people, particularly around the research that's emerging around brain development, pro-social development, that a lot of our prisons, because they're so outdated, they're not really, they're not subscribing to a lot of those theories of changes now. And so it's an outdated model. An outdated model that does not work, that's really, really costly, and much more focused on punishment than on rehabilitation.
I will get into some of the alternatives that exist and that you think we need in a bit, but I want to talk about incarceration. I think a lot of people look at it as, yes, a last resort, but I've heard from people in the justice system who say we've got some young offenders who really need to be incarcerated. They're committing violent crimes. Even the best rehabilitation systems that we have don't seem to be working. Do we need some kind of last resort incarceration? Maybe something better than Lincoln Hills or Copper Lake, mm-hmm. but something.
Yeah, and I think it's a question of accountability. This is not a conversation, or the work that we're doing is not a conversation about the lack of accountability. It's about really looking at the way we're holding young people accountable now today, and the ways that we do that are not in the best interest of their development, and it's also not in the best interest of the communities from which they're coming from. There are young people who do need additional levels or additional supports, and sometimes those supports do need to be in secure settings where they are safe, where they can be safe themselves or safe from themselves, and then where our communities can be safe and be safe from those young people. But the way that we're doing it now just doesn't work. And I think data from not only Wisconsin but from all over the country shows that what we're doing with young people in our juvenile justice system across the country just does not work. Over a high percentage of young people within 3 years of recidivate back into the system. And a lot of times that leads to a pipeline right into the adult system. And so if we're seeing that amount of young people going back into the system, that's proof there that the system has to take some accountability in the ways that it is contributing to the rate of recidivism of young people going back into the system.
Talking to Jeff Roman from the group Youth Justice Milwaukee, they have a poll out showing a lot of support for alternatives for reform of juvenile justice and a sentiment to avoid incarceration where possible, and if incarceration is needed, to keep it closer to home, more access to family and community. Jeff, let's talk about some of the alternatives that might be in place, say, in an area like Milwaukee now. What positive signs do you see in the community?
Well, I think we're seeing a lot of positive signs. I think what gets lost in the conversation, especially here in communities like Milwaukee, is that these young people are coming from a community that lack resources, that lack interest and genuine care for these young people, and that there are not experts and expertise in the communities from these young people come from. We know that simply is not just isn't true here in Milwaukee and in other places around the country. there are organizations and individuals who are working working with young people before they go into the system, as they are coming out and working with their families and have real tangible linkages and real life experience that relate to the young people. And the better that we can lift those organizations up and extend or scale the work that they're doing, the better results and outcomes we're going to have for young people here in Milwaukee. And there are a lot of examples of that work happening here and in other counties across the state that we can look to be able to really transform the way that we think about and deploy youth justice here in Milwaukee.
Now, according to the poll that your organization released, there's a pretty substantial majorities of people who support efforts like the ones you're talking about and trying for rehabilitation first before incarceration. Do you see that translating at the policy level into support, into financial commitment to that kind of approach?
I think there are serious conversations that are happening at decision-making tables with our policymakers, not only at the state level, but across the state, at the county, and at some of the municipal levels as well. And I think the report, the polling that was released just recently from the Youth First Initiative and Youth Justice Milwaukee really speaks to and gives some validity to some of the conversations that are happening. A lot of times we make decisions as decision-makers and policymakers without sufficient information, sufficient data. And we have proof now, and we have, you know, documented proof, attitudinal proof of people here in Wisconsin who are saying in large numbers that they prefer to really have a real conversation about alternatives to incarceration based on a number of factors.
I want to talk to you about what we know about what works at various steps along the way. And you mentioned the phrase, you know, before a kid is in the system. Are there things that we know, interventions that we know that can keep kids from that first interaction, from that first crime that makes them part of the criminal justice system?
Sure. There are a number of things. And a lot of the work that we do is focus on the ACEs, the Adverse Child Experiences, and trauma-informed care. And we know that is an emerging field of not only theory, but of practice that's really has gained a lot of traction here in Milwaukee. And there are a number of programs, a number of organizations who apply sort of the practices of trauma-informed care just to figure out, you know, it's not a question of why did you do something or really why it gets to why did you do something instead of just trying to, hold you accountable right away. We want to really go deeper and really figure out what's led to, you know, why you are here, why you've done, or why there are certain behaviors that you're having. There's a reason for everything.
We've heard the phrase trauma-informed care a lot in Wisconsin lately from First Lady Tonette Walker, and her husband, Governor Scott Walker, mm-hmm. has mentioned that himself. Are you encouraged by that kind of talk at a high level in Wisconsin government?
I'm encouraged that the conversations are happening, and I mean, I want to give credit where credit is due, that both Governor Walker and his wife have been doing some really significant work here in Milwaukee around trauma-informed care. I don't think that, I think there's more work for other decision makers to do. Just having a conversation is just one part of the process. We have to take those conversations and apply those to actual policy decisions and funding decisions that really impact the words that we're seeing.
We're talking to Jeff Roman. He's a member of Youth Justice Milwaukee. He's with us to talk about a new poll that shows a majority of Wisconsinites are in favor of keeping young people out of youth prisons like Copper Lake or Lincoln Hills. We'd like to hear from you. What reforms would you like to see in the state? Should Wisconsin maintain a zero-tolerance approach or come up with a different way to punish young people who commit crimes? Let us know what you're thinking over on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Jeff Roman from Youth Justice Milwaukee about a new poll that shows a majority of Wisconsin residents would prefer to see young people who commit crimes rehabilitated instead of being sent to youth prisons like Copper Lake or Lincoln Hills. And we'd like to hear from you. What are your thoughts on the youth prison system? If you went through that system yourself in the state, what did you take away from your time there? If you're a parent whose child has gone through Wisconsin's youth correctional system, what impact did that have on your family? Leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to our callers now. Bonnie is with us in Waukesha. Bonnie, hi.
Hi. I was wondering if any of the youth offenders get medical checkups right away, because I know that oftentimes there are medical problems that can lead to violence, like if there's a thyroid problem, people with thyroid problems frequently become tending toward violence, and once they're under treatment for their thyroid problem, they become much less violent.
Thanks for the call, Bonnie. Let's widen that even, Jeff. I mean, are there things that look into maybe a medical problem like that, maybe a mental health needing treatment, other problems that might be maybe an underlying cause of criminal activity?
Yeah, and there are, to speak to what's offered within the actual facilities, we do know that there are mandates for healthcare provision and for various screening processes to, you know, assess where young people are mentally and cognitively and behaviorally, and that's a part of the screening process when young people are sent through the system into the correctional facilities. I think our position is that those screening tools and the tools that are being used can be updated, can be more reflective of some of the cognitive behavioral kind of strategies or methods that are in existence today. For example, the trauma-informed care and the ACEs, the adverse childhood experiences assessment tools. We're not sure of the extent to which those are being used and to the extent that those are being sort of applied in the correctional facility. But I think it leads to a bigger question. To what extent are the correctional facilities in the state engaging really the expertise from experts in those fields, but also expertise from the communities to inform what those strategies would be? And we think that the way that engagement is happening desperately needs to be heightened up and broadened.
Bonnie, thanks for the call. We'll go next to David with us in Hayward. David, hi.
Yeah, I wanted to comment as a parent that I think following a period of incarceration, if offense requires that, you know, that given that sort of resource put into a juvenile offender, they should be followed in the community in a little tighter way to ensure that they would get education or a job skill, something to start to be a participator in community. Rather than be just, you know, out of jail or out of prison and then on their own again. I think that promotes recidivism. And I think if they had a tighter connection with gaining some skills to take care of themselves better, this is just common sense in my view, essential. I don't think it's happening.
David, thanks for the call. Is it happening, Jeff, some kind of help transitioning out of incarceration for, this comes up for older offenders, but for young offenders in particular?
Yeah, I think it goes to the question of scale and to the development of more culturally responsive and culturally appropriate strategies that are being used. We do know that there are various services that young people and their families do receive as they are coming back into or being integrated back into the community. I believe that there are a number of additional providers and other strategies that could be used and scaled to be able to better support those young people. And those need to be incorporated incorporated into the individual plans with the young people as they are inside the facility and as they are coming out. And so that it's what we like to call a soft transition after being released. And so the resources do exist. It's a question of scaling and really making sure that they're culturally appropriate for the young people.
Thanks for the call. We're talking about the youth justice system and alternatives to incarceration with Jeff Roman from Youth Justice Milwaukee. Back to our callers. Stacy is on the line in Portage. Stacy, hi.
Hi there. I'm calling as a consumer, and also I happen to be a provider of services. I work with at-risk kids, and unfortunately I have a kiddo who has been an at-risk kid through no fault of our own, that he experienced a lot of trauma. And, I did a lot of things to try to keep him out of trouble, but the services just, they kind of aren't there until you're already in trouble, no matter how much a parent begs and needs it. Right now the system is very reactive, and I think anybody in Child Protective Services or Juvenile Justice can agree with that you can't get the help until it's too late. Fortunately for us, my son was able to go to Rawhide as opposed to, you know, something a bit more punitive and less restorative. And, you know, there's been a lot of time and energy poured into us, and I am so thankful because my son is not lost. And if we hadn't have had that,
I don't, you know, if it had just been punitive, even though I knew he was in there, I needed the help to keep him from, you know, a worse future.
Stacey, thanks so much. Good luck to him and the kids you work with, for that matter. Jeff, to her first point there, service is not there, she says, until there's a crisis, not before there's a
sure.
crisis.
And I think that's that. I think that is the point that I want you all to leave with, is that we do have a very reactive system, and unfortunately, the resources that do exist, they are for those who have been involved within the system. I think that again shows that the model that we are using, our justice model for young people that we're using, is fundamentally outdated and flawed, in that it does not consider the preventative things that need to be in place and really invest on the front end of providing supports to young people, their families, and the communities that they come from, so that we don't have to invest the millions of dollars that we invest on the back end to incarcerate them, and then to provide minimal services on the back end.
Stacey, thanks. Erica is with us now in Kewaskum. Hi, Erica.
Hi. I had previously worked as an AODA counselor in the local jail and for adolescents, and it wasn't necessarily because they had AODA-related offenses, but...
It's alcohol or other drugs, right?
Right. A lot of them, unfortunately, were in there, you know, several times because they just really didn't even mind being in there, and getting to know them, a lot of them... came from houses that, you know, they didn't have the kind of support that they needed in order to have thought patterns otherwise. You know, they didn't care that they were doing these things and getting in trouble, because a lot of times their parents were doing the same. And, you know, they definitely need the support, like rehabilitation-wise, in order to make some sort of change in their life.
Erica, thanks for the call. Jeff, is there help out there for parents who maybe are going through similar things that their kids are going through in the justice system?
I think that's a fair question. And I think the reality is, just as we talk about the minimal resources for young people, there needs to be an increase in resources for parents on the front end, and working with parents to get the supports that they need. I think what we're seeing, what we are seeing, especially in communities like Milwaukee, is that we have a relatively young population of people who are having children at a younger age, or had been having children at a younger age, that contributes to the context of what we see today, which tells me that we need to be working with our policymakers and decision makers again on really scaling the resources and investment that we put into supports on the front end, prevention and family support, and in education, like the other caller said, and making sure that there are opportunities for economic development and business creation and growth in communities like Milwaukee that are deterrents to the symptoms that we see, violence and the various things that leads to young people being incarcerated.
We'll leave it there for now. Jeff, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Jeff Roman. He's a member of Youth Justice Milwaukee. He joined us to talk about a new poll just released that shows a majority of Wisconsinites would like to see young people who commit crimes kept out of youth prisons like Copper Lake and Lincoln Hills. There's still time to share your thoughts and experiences over at the Central Time Facebook page. And by the way, while you're there, you can find recipes from today's Food Friday guest, Patty Heenich, on the Central Time Facebook page. We've got some links to her recipes for chicken tinga tostadas, Mexican meatballs with mint, and chipotle chicken pasta casserole. So definitely try those recipes. Good inspirations for cooking over the weekend. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.